Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a special Alfresco Festival edition. I'm here in Amsterdam for IDFA, and I'm very pleased to have, for the first time on the podcast, talking about films, performances. We'll get into all of that, but let's welcome Julian Ross. Hello.
Hello there. Thanks for the invitation.
Yes, absolutely. Overdue. So, well, just to start with, what are you up to here in Amsterdam these days?
Yeah, well, actually, I live here, so it's one of those strange things when a festival takes place in your city, you're kind of juggling, usual life and festival. So I've been trying my best to kind of dive into what IDFA has to offer. I used to work in Rotterdam Film Festival, which takes place in January, February every year. So usually November is too busy for me to go to the festival. So, this is the first year in a long time that I've been able to see films, performances, see people. So, yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
That's good. Yeah. I know the feeling of being locked into a certain schedule for a while and then having freedom to work around it. We'll talk about a couple of films from the film part of the program, but I was really intrigued to hear a particular section that you've been attending, IDFA on Stage. Yeah.
I believe they've been doing it for the past few years, but this year they have 9 performances taking place at various venues within the festival. Some of them are like one-on-one performances or experiences, let's say, and some are, a theater where, frankly speaking, it's hard to kind of locate where cinema has anything to do with in the presentation. So you get all sorts of performances touching on documentary in some way, I suppose. Yeah, it's been going on for the past few years, and I was intrigued by it as someone who's a fan of film expanding beyond the usual kind of presentation in the cinema and the kind of exploration of that. And I was intrigued by the proposition that a documentary festival has a section presenting something on stage, which feels a bit contradictory, like a paradox. So
yeah, I almost began to think, does that make it more fictional or more non-fictional? because the fact of staging it, and having to repeat it, but also it's live, which is a kind of, I don't know. But there was one particular performance that was one of the ones that stood out for you.
Yeah. I mean, just to jump on what you were saying there, like where to locate like the reel or something was a really big question, I think, throughout IDFA on Stage. And like some performances really had nothing to do with film. Like there were no screens or projections or anything. There was one called Funeral that was just like experiencing this kind of ritual that you go through in a funeral, but together with audiences you've never met before. They made an effort they asked me when I walked in to give a name of somebody that I miss who's passed away. So you're encouraged to kind of be in your thoughts with this person. And that's a very, very interesting way to bring real emotions into an experience, I felt. And there's also the more traditional documentary theater that you find there. So just kind of performances taking place with screens that were projecting, I guess, documentary images. But one work that I saw that I really liked was by a filmmaker called Maxime Jean-Baptiste. And this performance was called Between Nothingness and Infinity, I Began to Weep. And this work is going to be a feature film eventually. So in a way, this is kind of a work in progress presentation. Or him trying to experiment with things that I suppose he wasn't finding the space to experiment with within the format of a film. And the film and this performance is about his cousin. I believe his name is Lucas, who died when he was 18 years old. He was stabbed to death at a party in French Guinea. I believe they were close, and this film is kind of going to be about his death, but not the moment of violence, but the reverberations after, what his life meant before as well, of course. So as a performance, there were readings of letters between Maxime, who's very present in the performance, and a couple of other performers. You saw documentary images, presumably that will end up in the film as well.
Are those stills or video?
Video. Yeah. So okay, like interviews with this man, Lucas's best friend, for example, who was present in the moment of his death and things like this, and his family members. I believe Maxime Jean-Baptiste works quite a lot with family members. And what he does in the performance is that he becomes kind of a vessel or a host for the spirit of Lucas. and speaks from his perspective. There's also kind of dance performance that's involved where he kind of does this. I don't know if you've seen the music video of Flying Lotus's Never Catch Me Now. Amazing song and amazing music video. It's a funeral that takes place of two children, and everybody's mourning them, but they kind of wake up in their coffins and do this kind of reverse like a resurrection and disappear out of the church. It's it reminded me of that, what he does. He's like, Maxime's on the floor, dead as Lucas, and he kind of reverses the stabbing and wakes up and kind of... If you've seen his film From Form Expanded this year, he works with archival images in this kind of jittery way. And it was almost like a performance, but working with that jitteriness within the performance.
That's interesting. So, well, I'm also fascinated by the idea of a performance that's, I guess, partly memorial in a way. But also, I mean, with an idea of like resurrection, there's, I mean, it's something you can't do with a documentary necessarily. It's filmed. So that's interesting.
Dealing with things like ghosts and spiritual, not as a metaphor, but just kind of really channeling that idea as a performance. I really liked, and what I loved about this performance is that it, according to the images I saw, the film I saw, this work is going to be not just about that moment of violence, but just like what happens to like a family, all these people afterwards. And it's not about the violence of this moment, but just everything around it, you know? And I think this, the performance really allowed space for that because it was, you know, partially a reading, partially performance, partially fragments from a film. There are all these moments where you're kind of circling around that one moment of this man Lucas's life, you know?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I'm very curious to see what the filmed documentary phase of this artwork will be. That's really cool.
Just to add one thing, apparently he told me afterwards that he isn't going to be as present as much in the film itself. I think it's going to be a very different register in that sense because he's so hyper-present in the performance. He's like the host. He's the one who's reading. He has this kind of physical relationship with the images that they're projecting. But in the film itself, he's not going to be as present. So it really shows like what an artist can do when you offer these different opportunities, or one project can have different iterations. I think he felt he couldn't do that for a film, but he could for a performance. And it's great that IFFA allows space for that kind of experimentation, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, now if I think about it, I mean, in the form of the, when he films the documentary, his presence will be the point of view. I mean, effectively, when he is the filmmaker, that's how he's there. But it's interesting to think what it is in a performance form. Cool. So that's IFFA on stage.
That's right. Yes.
So let's talk about one of the conventionally filmed documentary, but this is another kind of exception or another kind of variation, a movie that I guess has a certain profile. It'd be easy to call it kind of notorious, although it's just very strong material, I guess you'd say. And it's called Manifesto. And in the Envision section, and it's a Russian filmmaker, but who is anonymous, basically, as I understood it.
No, he's, there's a name.
There's a name, but I think I was told that that's not like a real name.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I don't know. Part of the reason being is because it has a very controversial candor about what goes on in Russian schools and specifically, I don't know. Do you want to try to summarize it? Or
I could try. Yeah. I mean, it's a found footage film.
It's found footage film. Yeah.
It is entirely comprised, if I understood correctly, from footage that was uploaded by Russian teenagers onto TikTok and YouTube.
Yeah.
I was looking at the credits where they list, you know, the URL and the kind of name of the video. It seemed like it was from like 2015-16 to more recent years.
Yeah.
And you get like a real insight into like teenage life in mostly rural Russia, from if I understand.
Yeah.
From the very mundane to the extremely violent moments.
There's a kind of horrible progression to the movie because it starts out with, in a way, kind of innocent, well, definitely innocent videos, you know. I thought the whole movie almost goes through the whole, like, different types of YouTube videos there are. So the beginning are just, like, these wake-up videos or, like, even these, like, wake-up and make-up kind of videos and here's me going to school videos. And also just younger kids generally, like, I guess sort of tweenish or around there. But then and then they get to school and it's a lot of classroom footage. And that's where you get the first kind of taste of something is wrong. there's a kind of an illness or something in societal illness. I mean, the reason you have that sense is because immediately you see that all the teachers that, at least in these videos, are like abusive, verbally abusive, physically abusive, just like relentless streams of, you know, calling people idiots and everything. On and on, and just like also aggressive patriotism, indoctrination, which is hard to watch.
No, it really is. It's like you say, it's a real progression from the very immediate personal wake up, make up videos, as he called it, to what happens in school, and you get a real insight into like the school system and what kind of rhetoric is being perpetuated within those educational institutions. And it's really horrific to watch because it's very violent. And
and a lot of times you can see that the phones that they're using to record are hidden, you know, because if they're discovered, and there's, I guess, an early kind of climactic point of the movie is where they have hidden footage of just a teacher beating a student in like a hallway, and you can hear another student saying like, we should go, stop filming, you know. So you get a sense not only of the violence but also the fear that's like pervasive.
Then forced apology videos where they're clearly like reading some kind of text above the camera, and
that's a whole other phase, because then I mean things like shift into an even higher gear of just dreadfulness with, I guess, a school shooting. So there is like multiple perspectives on, I think, actually multiple shootings. It's not just one event. At first, I thought it was like, we're, you know, like it's Gus Van Sant's elephant or something. We're tracking it from different. But then I realized it's different events. So all the violence that was within the context of a classroom and somehow within the hierarchies of like teaching, which is awful enough, just burst into a whole nother level with like actual guns.
Yeah. And axes and knives, although we see the gun crimes more. But it was really, I didn't know Russia has so many school shootings and all these kind of incidents. Yeah. So that was kind of a shock for me. But as the way the film presents it is that it's a frequent occurrence, right?
Yeah.
And it's really horrific images that the director have decided to show, where it's, you know, not just the aftermath or people running away, but like you really see people dropping dead from a shot and all this, and jumping out of windows from like the third floor to escape this kind of horror.
So by now, I can imagine listening to this and wondering like, how is this even like a documentary that holds together? And I mean, they give you the sense of this is where all the like violence and all the violent rhetoric goes, you know, that when it's communicated and indoctrinated top down in like a militaristic totalitarian regime, that it just doesn't disappear, you know, that somehow it gets relayed down. And I say that also just because the teachers are explicitly talking about Putin.
Yeah.
And the students and their resistance are like, at one point they're like putting like a portrait of Putin in the trash or something. You know? So you get a sense of that opposition. And then there's a break a bit where they have sort of performance videos of people kind of switching off, singing a protest song, which is a good thing they do that then, because you need some feeling of some type of liberation or some type of escape. But then they bring you back to hell. And that's the last sequence that I think we both had a bit of trouble with.
Yeah. First of all, it's the one sequence that lasts a long time, and you really get to know the people present. It's a couple who have committed some kind of shooting. You see them shooting from an apartment window into police cars. So, and over 10, 15 minutes or so, you spend time with them in the way you haven't, you know, really done so with the other moments, because it's really a found footage fragmentary documentary. And how do I put it? They're contemplating, well, suicide and, you know, if and when to do it. It's pretty hard watch. And what did you think of this scene?
Well, it's strange because the first time I watched it cold and I saw what I thought I was seeing, which is what you described, you know, these two, I mean, they can't be more than 15.
Young.
14. But of course, they're like chain smoking. So, you know, it's just like, and they look like they're in this semi-inhabited like cabin or house, you know, that seems to be in sort of town. And they're kind of like talking themselves up into like, oh, we're going to kill ourselves. And they're saying, oh, the SWAT team, where's the SWAT team, or whatever the Russian equivalent is, the special forces team. Why aren't they here? they're going to be coming. They are coming.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that we do get a depiction of what they are talking about doing.
Yeah.
It's not a video depiction. It's an audio depiction.
Yeah.
So I guess you could say maybe it isn't actually happening, that they're shooting themselves. I took it that they were shooting themselves.
That's how I took it, too. Yeah. I think.
And so for me, it felt like an unnecessary step, and especially given how the whole film is already like constructed, this whole horrible like armature of fear and death, and so to actually have that at the end, I didn't know what that was doing, and I feel like whenever you do that, you're losing something.
Oh yeah,
by showing that and seeing that.
Yeah, so they probably shoot themselves, and the young boy, I guess, he puts the phone down. I don't know what's going through his mind, but he decides not to show it in this stream.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I just felt the filmmaker behind it being like, yeah, this is perfect. I don't have to actually show this brutal act, but everything before and also the sound is there.
Yeah.
It felt such a like yes moment for this film. And I had really trouble with the framing of this film with the iPhone alarm that goes off in the beginning and also the end.
Uh-huh.
I guess it's going for the this film is a wake-up call for or Russia or whatever, and it just seems so like tidy, and it's kind of purporting to be at least like this kind of tidy statement where you know, and I just felt deeply uncomfortable with that last scene. I just didn't really see why the filmmaker decided to put us through this horror of getting to know these people in a very intimate way, and then
well, it just seems like whoever they are, whatever they've done, they seem disturbed partly, and just to show that seems like some kind of transgression of some, I won't say ethical, but just some dignity in a way. And I feel like when you show death in that way, you don't have to show it or depict it for us to know it happens. And when that happened at the end, a lot of the stuff that I thought was kind of smart till then, I began to question whether it was as smart as I thought it was. I also want to mention that in the very beginning, I'm not sure if this was specific to our screening because the filmmaker was not there. We were talking about whether the filmmaker is actually who the name under the director credit is, or whether it's like an anonymous, it's like a pseudonym. I've heard it's a pseudonym, but in the beginning there's like a director message. Was that in the one you saw?
Yeah.
Which was also just like a certain genre of lo-fi protest art, you know, this like collage photo of people at the funeral of like Russian, what is it again, when he steps aside from the grave that he's in front of, because it's like distorted voices deliver this message. It's like a kidnapping note or something, you know.
Oh, wow. I thought you meant the written statement that this film is not a political film.
Oh, well, that was interesting, too. Yeah. No, there was a video message before.
Oh, really? No, I didn't see that, no.
Yeah, it was this whole tableau of a funeral setting, but what's being put to rest is, like, the future of Russia.
Okay.
It was so over the top that I kind of went with it. But that's true. There also was, like, that text message that, was clearly a protection, I guess.
Yeah.
To say that this is not, like, insurrectional material or, like, revolutionary material. So the one last thing I'll say about that final sequence that was so troubling, I did, right after the movie, I was just kind of sputtering, you know, and then someone said, well, special forces were not there. That's all in their head. It was clearly in their head. I had two people I watched with, so it was all clearly in their head. And that's interesting if that's true, but that was not my interpretation. But if we run with that interpretation, then the idea is that they've totally internalized this, like, you know, climate of fear and paranoia, which is interesting. I just wasn't convinced of that, and that's not how I took it.
No,
I just throw that out there.
That's an interesting thought, because you do literally see them shooting into, like, police cars, so...
There's, like, it looks like no one's in... It's like a parked car.
You're right.
But I mean, they weren't just having, like, a Bonnie and Clyde fantasy. I thought that they had done something. I don't know. It's possible, but,
Yeah.
I don't know. So, and then what happens right after you hear the gunshots that are self-inflicted gunshots, the title of the movie comes up, Manifesto.
Exactly. Yeah. No, this is what I'm talking about. I just feel the filmmaker's hands and, like, how pleased this person was discovering this footage as a kind of perfect ending. And that was what kind of repulsed me. Although, like...
Yeah.
What it was kind of working with before about, you know, the school system and how oppressive it is, and the kind of, you know, very unique insight you get into these people's worlds where it's pretty special.
Yeah, it's true. It reminded me a little of like post-Soviet bloc, like art dramas I've seen that are depicting kind of these bullying worlds. There's like, I want to say there's like a Kazakh filmmaker made this movie Harmony Lessons. I don't know if you remember that. That was all set, all like bullying in like a concrete slab of a school that I kind of flashed to when I saw this. But yeah, that's Manifesto. I don't know. Again, I'm glad to have seen something like, well, I don't know if I'm glad to have seen it. I'm glad I've grappled with it, I guess.
Yeah, no, totally. I was looking for an opportunity to discuss that film because I have many feelings watching that film, and it's good to kind of share that with other people, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm sure people will talk more about that wherever it does get screened. Mm. Switching gears to a film that was a highlight for you, a mid-length film, which I'm really glad to feature, actually, because I think, you know, just out of habit, as much as anything, we don't always talk about mid-length and shorts.
Yeah, the film's called Cesar's Summer by a Dutch documentary filmmaker called Marina Meyer. Mm-hmm. She showed at ITFA a couple of years ago in 2019 a film called Carousel, which also played in the international competition in Cinema Durell in 2020. But that film kind of got buried because of the pandemic, I suppose. But it was an amazing film about a center called A New Chance in Rotterdam, where young, troubled people went to get a new chance to kind of reintegrate into working life when they've been kicked out of schools and working places and things. And what that film did was basically, it was about an institution, but she shot close-ups of the documentary subjects from a distance with a long lens. So everything around them was kind of blurry, but it was very present still, which, you know, you could read all sorts of things into, just like, you know, their surroundings and everything like that. And just like with what I was talking about with Maxime Jean-Baptiste's work, it was a film that didn't just focus on their kind of angry outbursts, but what happens before and after and the kind of complications of relationships in such spaces. Mm-hmm. But it had this really strong formal through line, the whole film. Mm-hmm. Basically, it was about a space that you never see. Mm-hmm. You just see the faces that inhabit it. Yeah, so brilliant film. And Cesar's Summer is one of the three or four main documentary subjects in Carousel is called Typhoon, and his brother is called Cesar. I guess Marina Meyer got to know him and his family pretty well, and Cesar's Summer is basically about their family life in the summer before Cesar has to basically follow his brother's footsteps and is kicked out of school and has to be looked after outside of the family system. So it's about the difficulties of facing. The guy has ADHD, he's autistic, and he has violent outbursts and disappears. And, you know, there are many things that make his life more difficult than many other people. So on the one hand, he needs structure that a system provides. But on the other hand, that family has experienced his brother go through that system that hasn't really led anywhere.
Right.
So it's about this family facing that reality that's probably going to have to happen, but resisting it with all their might. And you really get this very intimate portrait of this family dealing with this situation. And I wanted to kind of share that because, it's in the mid-length documentary section, and not many people spend their time watching mid-length films. But I really think Marina Meyer is a special documentary filmmaker here in the Netherlands, and it would be great to see Carousel programmed with this film, you know? Yeah, so.
For sure. Maybe I'll just talk quickly about one movie that I saw, Wisdom Gone Wild, and it's by Ria Tajiri. And you can actually watch one of her most famous works, which I think is from 91 or so, called History and Memory. It's on Criterion Channel right now, which is about, she's Japanese-American, so her family's experience in the internment camps that were set up in the U.S. in World War II and grappling with that and her family's history. In this film, she zeroes in on her mother as she, I really like how the movie describes it, because I don't want to just say like as she copes with dementia. It's more like, in the movie they phrase it like, as she communicates differently, as she relates differently, because the whole movie is about kind of not looking from the outside in at her, but trying to almost look from the inside out for her and to follow where she's going with her thoughts. And like at one point she She thinks that Rhea is her sister who passed away. Rhea Tajiri just kind of embraces that, you know, and says, that makes me feel a connection with that past sister who passed away because she was also interested in art, you know, and that sort of thing. And it's just an incredibly shot movie because it's all this highly attuned handheld camera work. Also just like trying to draw her mother out. But her mother is also like very funny and like sharp-tongued or sharp-witted, but, you know, also just can get angry and frustrated. So that happens. It's a remarkable movie. And I feel like I have seen like more than one documentary trying to depict this sort of process that can happen with, you know, loved ones as they age and things change. I have to say there's really something special about this. And that, I mean, it's no surprise given the filmmaker. So yeah, that's Wisdom Gone Wild. And I think her nephew or cousin did the music on it. And Julian, you were just telling me that there's another kind of connection, like a Dutch connection.
Yeah, I'm still like trying to figure this out. But basically, there's an artist called Shinkichi Tajiri, who is, he was Japanese-American, who moved to Europe after World War II, spent some time in Paris, Berlin, ended up in the Netherlands, married the Ferdy, another, I believe, a Dutch artist, here and spent his time in Amsterdam. Yeah, also a filmmaker, actually. But in any case, I showed a film of his maybe 8 years ago or something like this. And so I got in touch with his daughter. And they were saying that I believe the composer is a relative of theirs.
Yes.
And I think, yeah, Tajiri, the same surname. It makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to have that in because that was sort of a nice connection in the movie. I felt like the mother is beauty stylist and had like this really precise eye for images and paintings too, apparently. And I thought that was interesting. And there's drumming in the movie that's done by Rhea Tajiri's brother, who appears in the movie. So I don't know. It all sort of coalesces in this nice way. Wisdom Gone Wild and History and Memory is the other one.
Nice.
So I think we can probably wrap up there. That's just a sort of a sampling of stuff at IDFA. Very glad we got to talk about these few selections. Do you know what you're going to see next already? Or
I think I'm going to catch up with All That Breathes.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I haven't seen
it
yet. Couple of my colleagues are going, so I'm going to join them tomorrow morning.
Julian, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.